what does the Bible say about astronomy? What does the Bible say about the cosmos, the stars? Today we're going to be hearing from Dr. Danny Faulkner. Welcome to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast. Welcome back, friends. Yeah, today we're going to be hearing from Dr. Danny Faulkner. Some of you guys might recognize his name from the film that just came out recently called Is Genesis History? He was in that film along with several other amazing men who are part of the creation science movement. But a little bit about Danny Faulkner, other than the fact that he was in the Is Genesis History movie. He works for Answers in Genesis. He's earned graduate degrees in both physics and astronomy and is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at University of South Carolina, Lancaster, where he taught for over 26 years. Dr. Faulkner is a member of the Creation Research Society and also serves as the editor of the Creation Research Society Quarterly. He's published more than 100 papers in various astronomy and astrophysics journals and is the author of Universe by Design. We're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. And the new astronomy book, also talk about that a little bit towards the end as well. He's currently part of the staff. He is currently a staff astronomer at Answers in Genesis. Actually, this marks a historic moment. This is the first time I've had somebody from Answers in Genesis on the show, which makes me very excited. I love Answers in Genesis. They are one of my very favorite ministries that are out there. And so a very hearty welcome to Dr. Danny Faulkner. Danny, welcome to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
The pleasure is all mine. And yeah, I just want to thank you too for your role in that movie, Is Genesis History. Awesome. Love the movie. I generally have a pessimistic attitude about Christian movies that come out. And when I see one that is a gem, I get very excited. And that was a really good one. So kudos on that. And friends, if you haven't seen that movie, you got to check it out. They bring in several PhD'd gentlemen who speak on various subjects around creation. So they have Dr. Andrew Snelling is in there talking about geology. We have Dr. Danny Faulkner. I'm drawing a blank. Boyd is in there talking about the Hebrew text.
Stephen Boyd?
Yes, Stephen Boyd. Just a great lineup of guys. So yeah, friends, if you haven't seen it, you got to check that out. Well worth it. And so today we're going to be talking about Dr. Faulkner's book, The Created Cosmos. It's a lot of fun. So Danny, why did you write this book? What's it all about?
Well, the subtitle in the book is What the Bible Reveals About Astronomy. And, you know, there have been a couple of books written in the past. One was a couple astronomers wrote books way back in the first decade of the 20th century. E. Walter Maunder wrote a book on basically by biblical astronomy. The other one was an Italian named Schiaparelli, who wrote about biblical allusions in the Old Testament. And, you know, there hasn't been a book written like that in more than a century. And I thought, well, the time's right. So I began researching this a few years ago. I read through those books and did some own study of my own, and I thought, well, this needs to be updated. So I gave a presentation on it a few times and kind of expanded it. And it was about 2 years ago, I guess, I decided to sit down and just start writing this thing. And it came together. We finished my editing on it back last spring, late spring, and then it came out in August. So just if you want to learn, you know, everything the Bible has to say about astronomy and revealing things, it's a good reference to go to.
It really is. It really is. And it is like everything concerning the Bible and astronomy. I mean, you have so many different topics that you address in that book. It's really fun read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So How does the Bible portray the cosmos differently from that of the surrounding cultures and worldviews of ancient times?
Oh, that's a huge can of worms right there. You know, it's very fashionable now, even among conservative biblical circles, ostensibly conservative circles, to refer to the A&E, the ancient Near East, and to argue that the Bible is a product of the A&E, and it is. I mean, the people were living in ancient times in the Middle East, and there's certain customs and so forth that it really helps to understand some of the cultures better to make sense of it. I'll give you an example really quickly. Mary was betrothed to Joseph, and we say, well, they were engaged. Well, it's not quite like that. It's much more serious than that. In many respects, they were already married. They just hadn't consummated the marriage, and we have no custom like that. And unless you understand that custom, then you don't really get what's going on there. And there are many other examples. But on the other hand, what most people mean today by, you know, the A&E culture and being important for biblical interpretations is they're saying that particularly the first few chapters of Genesis were heavily influenced by the pagan cultures around them. And so they say the first few chapters of Genesis just reflects that worldview, and maybe it's a polemic against the other pagan cultures or something, and they said it's not terribly different. And that then leads them to dismiss the first few chapters of Genesis, which, is, of course, talks about the beginning of the world. And I think that seriously undermines the integrity of Scripture and the authority of Scripture and the inspiration of Scripture. And if you really read Genesis and just ask, well, what is this text telling us? It is a very different account of how the world began. You don't have a bunch of gods warring over things. It doesn't teach a particular cosmology, despite what people claim about, you know, supposedly it was the domed cosmology it was talking about. It doesn't talk about that at all. And I wrestled as I've tried to work with this. My own thinking about biblical cosmology has changed over the last two or three years. And, you know, you really need to let the text speak and understand what the Hebrew words mean and how we should translate those. And then try to understand it. I'm a product of the 20th and 21st century, so I'm going to be kind of putting on those glasses and have to work through that. But I am convinced that the creation account is very different, dramatically different from what you find in other ancient cultures.
Yeah, I agree. And, okay, something you brought up there when you were talking, you talked about the canopy, and you also talked about some of these meanings of these Hebrew words. Well, when I was reading a section of your book, it really got me thinking because I've been raised up under the canopy model, okay? And the idea that, well, there's this Hebrew word in the Old Testament that is used for or translated firmament, and it's rakia. I believe that's how you translate it, how you say it. I shortly after getting saved, I was introduced to Kent Hovind. And Kent Hovind is very strong in the idea of a hard, or a like a canopy, like this not a dome, but like a layer around the earth that played a pivotal role in the flood. You introduced some ideas about this rakia, this firmament, that I had not really heard before. So, yeah, first of all, can you explain the canopy theory a little bit and then explain how you see rakia, what that is, and why?
Yeah, the large part of this thing about the vapor canopy was attributed to Henry Morris.
Henry Morris,
Jr. He and John Whitcomb launched the modern creation movement back in 1961 with the publication of the Genesis Flood. And mm-hmm. Henry Morris was a great man, a wonderful man. I had the pleasure of knowing him. He's been with the Lord now for more than a decade.
Yeah.
But he wrote about like 60 books. And he developed much of what we have the flood model today. If you are a recent six-day creationist today, you can trace your lineage back to Henry Morris. You either read him and learned from him directly, or you learn from people who learn from him, or learn from people who learn from people who learn from him. You know, he's that important.
Yep.
And one of his ideas was that the rakia made on day two, which is firmament in the King James, it's the expanse in some more modern translations, was the earth's atmosphere, and there was this layer of the rakia of day two was to divide the waters below and the waters above, and so waters below obviously would be the oceans, and the water above it would be, well, what? Something above this rakia. So he said since it was the atmosphere, then you had a water layer above the earth. It wasn't quite clear what form that was in, if it was in ice, water vapor, or in liquid water, but this water supposedly was suspended above the earth's atmosphere. And he said at the time of the flood, you know, if you look at Genesis 7, there are two sources of water. The fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and rain fell. And so he suggested there was tectonic upheaval that uplifted water from inside the, you know, the ocean basins. At the same time, this vapor canopy collapsed, and it caused rain to fall. And he also argued that rain hadn't fallen before. That goes back to something in Genesis 2 that many people misunderstand. And then he attempted to explain a bunch of other things with this canopy. For instance, the rainbow is mentioned in Genesis 9 as part of the Noahic covenant, the sign of the covenant. And as if that was something new, he said. So, you know, maybe this canopy prevented there to being rainbows before the flood. Actually, it doesn't have to mean that at all. It could be that the rainbow was there before. It just has a new meaning now. That's often been done with things. And he also argued the longevity would somehow be people before the flood. You know, they lived oftentimes 700, 800, 900 years. And perhaps that was caused by protecting people from radiation from space. And just all sorts of things that he tried to explain with this canopy. But, you know, over the years, by the way, back 40 years ago, 50 years ago, all of us were canopy believers. But, you know, slowly but surely, we begin to pull away from that. Number one, there was a scientist employed by Henry Morse, Larry Vardaman, who tried for years to get he was atmospheric physicist, atmospheric scientist, tried to get a canopy model to work, never could get it to work. Also, a lot of us began asking question, well, was there really no rainbow before the flood? Was there really no rain before the flood? We can't see that there's a strong case to be made in Scripture for that. And furthermore, you know, Psalm 149, I believe, 147, one of the late Psalms, talks about praising the waters above the heavens as if they were still there in the psalmist's day. This is definitely post-flood. So if the waters were still above the heavens after the flood, then it couldn't have condensed at the time to produce the flood water. So, you know, by the 1980s and 90s, we were really beginning to abandon that. And I don't know a single creation scientist today who still holds the canopy model. Certainly, my employer, Answers in Genesis, has retreated from that, as other creation ministries have as well. Still hasn't filtered down completely. There are people out there. You mentioned Kent Hovind. As far as I know, he still supports the canopy model. But many of us have kind of abandoned that. And so a couple of years ago, I sat down and asked myself the question, well, wait a minute. If this canopy, this rakia isn't the Earth's atmosphere, if you don't need that anymore to support the canopy model, then what is it? And I slowly came around after doing a lot of study and consideration. I began to realize I think it's talking about primarily space, a little bit of, maybe the atmosphere as well, but certainly space. And we have the firmament of heaven, if you will, the rakia of the Shemayim water. Shemayim is the word for heaven. And it's mentioned three times alone in the day four account. That's where God placed the heavenly bodies. And that is a pretty strong indication. It says the firmament of heaven, or the rakia of Shemayim, as if there's any question about exactly what rakia it's talking about. You find in Psalm 19:1, it says the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament, or the rakia, shows his handiwork. The poetic structure of the Psalms and the Proverbs and other Old Testament poetic books often works by parallels and contrast. And if you look at that, it's two parallel statements. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the rakia shows his handiwork. That only works if there's a parallel structure there, the rakia and the heaven being the same thing. Also in verse 8 of chapter 1, God called. It says explicitly he called this rakia heaven, Shemayim. So I think if you really study the whole context here, it's inescapable, really, that this rakia made on day two is talking about the space of the universe. And, you know, up to this point, again, following Henry Morris's lead, we thought that verse one was where God had made the space of the universe. That was my position for a long time. In fact, my first book I wrote back a dozen years ago, Cosmology, the Universe by Design, I actually teach that in there, and I'm hoping to go to a new edition on that book and make a few changes in it, because my mind has changed on this a bit. So that's my position, that this Rakia of Day 2 is the space of the universe for the most part, which then raises the question, well, what's this water above? And I've come to this conclusion that the water above is probably water at the edge of the universe. And right there are three startling things that I come up against. Number one, if the universe does, if this is what I'm, if I'm right about this, then the universe has an edge to it. It's finite and has an edge, and both those concepts are pretty anathema to modern-day cosmology.
Right.
And number two, if this expanse was spread out from the Earth somewhat symmetrically, it doesn't have to be, but that's just kind of the impression I get, then you're going to end up with the Earth being somewhere near the center of the universe. It doesn't have to be exactly at the center, but somewhere close by. And again, that's anathema. The idea is we're no particular location in the universe. And furthermore, even if there were a center, a lot of cosmology models today don't allow a center of the universe, but if there was one, what's the chance of us being anywhere near the center if there were one?
That's right. That's
right. And then number three, you've got this shell of water out there beyond the edge of the universe. And again, when I saw that a couple of years ago, it just blew my mind away. I thought, this is wild stuff. But, you know, the dominant cosmology has been for a half century is the we'll call it the Big Bang model. It's the idea that the universe suddenly appeared out of nothingness back 13.8 billion years ago. Space, time, matter, energy all popped into existence in a very hot, dense state, rapidly expanding, and it's expanded to the universe we see today. And one of the big proofs for that from 1965 was the discovery of what we call the cosmic microwave background, CMB for short. And the other cosmology considered at the time, what we call the steady state, it couldn't explain the existence of this background radiation. And so this was a big proof, as it were, of the Big Bang. And I've been stymied for, you know, half a century. Well, if we don't believe the Big Bang, and I don't believe the Big Bang, there are many problems with it biblically and I think also physically, but if we don't believe it, well, how can we explain this background radiation? And there have been several attempts in the past from creationists, and they all haven't done a very good job, actually. But you know what? If the universe is surrounded by water, then it's made out of what we call baryonic matter, normal matter, and normal matter has to radiate. It has to have some temperature. The third law of thermodynamics would seem to dictate that, in which case, if you have all this water at the edge of the universe in every direction, it would have to radiate at some temperature. It might not be that warm, particularly when you consider what we call the expansion of the universe, which I think is the expansion of the universe. That's observational science. And that would seem to suggest then a cool background radiation, which is exactly what we see. So out of all of my musings here, I actually stumbled upon an explanation for the cosmic microwave background, and I hope in the future to try to flesh that in a little bit better. But I just come around to these ideas in the last couple of years. I published it on our website at Answers in Genesis, and I've then put them in the book as well.
Very good. Okay, so according to the scriptures, what is the purpose of the stars?
Well, there's several given there in the book of the first chapter of Genesis. It says to provide light upon the earth, to divide the light from the dark, the day from the night, to be for signs, to be for seasons. And the seasons it mentions there is not referring to climatic seasons so much, you know, spring, autumn, summer, winter. The Hebrew word there is moed, and that word moed is the word for the festivals, Passovers and things like that, you know. And the, you know, the Passover and Sukkot, those high holy days, their dates are determined by the calendar, so they're for seasons as well. And that's what it's talking about, the Hebrew calendar being a lunisolar calendar. We worry about, you know, our date of resurrection Sunday bounces around in our calendar because we have a solar calendar. But on a lunisolar calendar, Passover occurs at the same time every year. It's always the 15th day of the first month of the ceremonial calendar. And that's one of the purposes given there. But for signs, I have a chapter in the book there on the Star of Bethlehem. That was definitely one of the signs. We also find a sign given to Hezekiah on the sundial. That was from a heavenly body as well. And we also see prophetic passages dealing with things in the heavens. Jesus told us about signs in heaven before his return of the Lord. So we have those signs being given to us. So a whole multitude of different purposes given there in the day four account of creation.
Right, right. And there's been so many movements that have sprung up around stars and the purpose of them. And it's clear from the scriptures, they're for signs and for seasons. And yet, you know, that word seasons is carrying the meaning of God's feasts, the feasts as prescribed in the Old Testament and in the Torah. But so many other movements like astrology, the idea that you can look at the stars and
what happens is there's every year as we orbit the sun, the sun appears to orbit through the stars once a year. There's a plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun we call it the ecliptic. And so every day, of course, the whole sky spins around due to the Earth's rotation, but once a year the sun seems to move from west to east through those stars, and there are 12 constellations along that path, and the sun will then spend about 1 month in each one of those constellations, and those constellations have familiar names to us, you know, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, and so forth. And the moon also follows an orbit within a few degrees of that, so it's always found in those same 12 constellations, as are the five naked eye planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. They look like bright stars. And, of course, to the ancients, the sun, the moon, and star, or the planets, were all deities. In fact, our names come from that. Sol was a Latin word for the sun, and the moon actually is a Anglo-Saxon word, I believe, but we also get the names of the planets from the Roman names, Mars, the god of war, Jupiter, the king of the gods, and so forth. And so this idea developed as an ancient pagan religion that the position of the sun and the moon and the stars on your birth and throughout your life would determine your destiny and your fate and so forth. So if you're born when the sun is supposedly in the constellation Leo, then that makes you a Leo. If you're in the constellation Sagittarius, then it makes you a Sagittarius. So everybody born over a month time is in one sign. And then astrologers is looking like a Rorschach test trying to figure out, well, if the sun's in this particular sign, the moon's in that sign, and so forth, what does this mean? Well, it means one thing if you're a Leo and something else if you're a Sagittarius. And so they've developed all these arcane rules and so forth. And we have a chapter in the book on this. And, astrology, people think it's kind of a harmless diversion. There are many people who've kind of wedded those together. In fact, I ran across a book a few years ago, actually three volumes set, and I have copies of them, been reprinted. A guy named William Lilly in the 17th century had a three-volume set called Christian Astrology.
Ooh.
And believe it or not, a lot of Christians thought that astrology was just fine, and they were commingling, of course, pagan beliefs. This is forbidden to us in the Old Testament, and it does detract us from the true and living God. And people actually practice astrology in a lot of places you would never imagine. Bloodletting, that was dictated where you would let blood out for some sort of illness, was dictated by your horoscope. And there are many people who would, plant by the signs. They consult the Farmer's Almanac, and it has the signs in there, where the signs are. Well, that's referring to the position of the moon with respect to these astrological signs. So even that's even astrology. So it takes many different forms, and I just want to warn Christians, you really shouldn't have anything to do with this. It's not a harmless diversion, and it's not Christian. It's anything but that.
Things haven't changed. I mean, even now, there are other pagan / New Age practices that continue to sneak into the church, Christian yoga. There is a lot of mysticism that seems to be showing up in churches nowadays, walking a labyrinth, so many different things that unfortunately, the Bible says, my people perish for lack of knowledge. And if you don't have discernment, you do generally start blowing around with every wind of doctrine. If you're not really having your face in the Word and finding out what this God we worship really wants of us and what he doesn't want. Yet you even have a chapter on this idea that there's a gospel in the stars. When I, shortly after getting saved, I read E.W. Bullinger's book. I think it's called A Witness in the Stars. And
yes, it is.
I highlighted that book to pieces. I still have it somewhere. And it actually it started to fall apart. I was so sold on it. And to be honest, I had the worst hurt feelings when I found out it was bogus.
Well, you know, you're actually wrong about one thing. I don't have a chapter. I have three chapters this book on it. And I've studied this off and on over the years. I first learned of this idea around 1979. I heard a radio program on it, and I thought, this is Nazi stuff. And I was already I was in graduate school studying astronomy. And my wife then was able to pick up a copy of Bullinger's book. That's probably the most influential book. It wasn't the original source. He published in the late 19th century, but the first one was written 150 years ago by Francis Rawlinson. And he and Joseph Seiss both read her book and then kind of repackaged it. And then other people have, we've got secondary and tertiary and quaternary sources on this. It's a very common belief out there, and, you know, people don't like their parade rained on. But I have studied this for more than 35 years off and on, and I've read everything I can on it, and I'm thoroughly convinced that it's bogus. It's not just bad, it's really bad. I'll give you a real quick one here. The whole thesis is that God, you know, came up with these names for the stars, and we do know from the Psalms that he does name the stars. But it doesn't necessarily follow that we know those names. He may not share them with us at all. And they claim then that the different names there had original soteriological meanings, that either God revealed it to Adam or Seth, or they made it up or something, these different constellation star names that have different salvation messages for us, because before there was a word given, they needed to preserve some sort of gospel truth. And they argue then that these names, you know, have different meanings, and so they'll pick star names and they'll go through some sort of lexicon of some Semitic languages such as ancient Hebrew and other related languages looking for homophones. And that was the technique or the approach that Ralston clearly wrote up in her book. And one of the best examples I can give you is Orion. They take this name, Orion. It comes from, we think, the Akkadian. It refers to some sort of shining thing, and they think, well, that's this light shining in the east, which is referred prophetically to, of course, to Jesus. Hmm. And they say that Orion is a type of Christ, and that you see that consistently played out in all of these things. Well, hold on a minute. I mean, you know that Orion is mentioned three times in the Old Testament, twice in Job, and once in the book of Amos. And all three times, the Hebrew word there is not Orion. They ignore that one. This is God's name for Orion because it's found in the Bible. In fact, it's even God's words being used here. And the Hebrew word is Kassil. And Kassil is one of the two Hebrew words translated fool in the Old Testament. Now, this is not the impious one. The impious, you know, the fool has said his heart does know God. That's the impious one. This one is merely the one who acts imprudently or foolishly. Well, excuse me, but Jesus is no fool.
Yes.
And I find that offensive. I find it very offensive to the point of being blasphemous. And, you know, if I show that to people, and the response is either, oh, you know, I didn't know, or it's the yes but me. Yes, but this, and this. People just won't let it go for some reason. And I've really gone through this, read all these books. I've gone through and checked the words, and their derivation, their etymologies are absolutely baseless in most cases. It's amazingly how bad it is. Francis Rawlinson found meanings of star names that started appearing on star charts during her lifetime. These are not ancient meanings at all, but she found ancient meanings in them anyway. It's really bad.
It is, and I understand the appeal. It's so much fun to have this extra little fun way to bring up a conversation with somebody and use this gospel in the stars to try to swing them back towards Christ and maybe share your faith with them. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of, who was that guy? Michael Drosnin, maybe? The guy that first rolled out the Bible code books.
That's it. Yep.
With the,
you know, I think it appeals to our pride here. It's kind of, I call it a form of Christian Gnosticism, the Bible code, the Gospel of the Stars and other things. It's this basic thing that I've kind of figured all of this out, and I've got this secret knowledge. One of the elements of Gnosticism was secret knowledge that took you to a higher spiritual plane, and it does appeal to the pride. And, you know, it's hard for people to accept that I understand this, and I think that people, you know, they get prideful by finding out this secret knowledge that they can then share with other people, and they too can become initiated. And that's a danger I see all over the place. You know, flat earth is another one. I see people really getting on fire over that because this is some sort of special secret knowledge that nobody else seems to know about. So that's a strong appeal for a lot of people. I don't quite understand it, but I recognize it when I see it.
Yeah, and I hate to say it, these things were fun when I first became a believer, and I was really interested in all the wild theories, but as you mature in your faith, you soon come to realize that you better have your facts straight, because people will call you out on it. You know, you try to use something like that, and intelligent people out there, they will shut you down, and you'll feel a little embarrassed. At that point, it feels like everything that you say from that point forward to this person has been thoroughly discredited. So, you know, stick to the facts, stick to the truth, and let's not go down any rabbit trails, at least with unbelievers.
That really rings ill repute upon beyond the cause of Christ, because if you go off some goofy things, then people discover they're goofy. They're going to say, well, everything else they're saying, including the gospel of Christ, is goofy. So we need to be very careful. We need to guard our truth carefully.
You know, speaking of goofy, you have a chapter in your book about this flat earth movement. And I've done 4 podcasts on this subject. And since you're on, I would love to hear why you think that the earth is in fact spherical and the flat earth movement is wrong.
Okay, this thing has really blown up in the last couple of years. I first became aware of this whole nonsense about a little over a year ago, 13 months ago. I had a few people sending me things in the email about the flat earth, but I had not really paid much attention to them. This thing really just jumped out at me. So I started really diving into it. I've watched more videos on YouTube than I care to admit. I'm trying to dig all I can out of it. And by the way, this thing has been, I think, almost exclusively promoted and promulgated through the internet. It's a shame that there's so many bad videos out there. If you just Google flat earth, you come up with, last time I did it, I think it was 110,000 hits, but it's probably far more than that now. And it's really insidious. Several things coming together here. First of all, it's common belief. I call it our cultural mythology. Everybody thought the world was flat until the time of Columbus 500 years ago. Now, that story doesn't even make any sense when you think about it, because supposedly he was going against ignorance and saying, well, you could get to Asia by sailing west from Europe. And they said, no, you can't. And, he sailed to part of the Caribbean and the Antilles and he then sailed back to Spain, did it 4 times. How does that prove the earth is spherical? Doesn't even make any sense when you think about it. And the story is that actually people have known the earth is spherical for a very long time. It was the first mention we have in the scientific literature, history of literature, goes back to Pythagoras in the 6th century B.C. He knew the earth was spherical because he noticed that every time you had a lunar eclipse, the shadow of the earth on the moon was always a sphere, a circle, part of a circle. And that can only happen, regardless of the orientation, if the earth is a sphere. You know, if the earth is round and flat like a pizza pan, sometimes it would cast a circular shadow, but not usually. So that was a pretty strong argument. There are others that soon followed. You know, around 200 BC, a man named Eratosthenes measured the size of the earth pretty accurately. But my students, when I taught the university for many years, are always kind of surprised to learn that one. They didn't quite jive with what they learned growing up. We all learned everybody thought the world was flat. Well, what happened? Well, the 19th century happened, and a lot of strange things came about then. One of them was what we call the Kant thesis, a guy named Andrew Dixon White, another man named John Henry Draper. They were both skeptics, and they wanted to do a real hatchet job on Christianity. This is the time when the Dark Ages was used to describe the Middle Ages. They really weren't that dark at all, but that's another story. And they put down a whole list of things that the church had supposedly gotten wrong. And you know, one of the things the Roman Catholic Church got wrong was it endorsed the geocentric theory, the Ptolemaic model, the epicycles to explain cosmology. That's another story. But one of the big arguments was that the church throughout time had taught that the earth was flat. And, of course, Christopher Columbus showed otherwise. That was a complete fabrication. There's no truth to it at all. In fact, a medieval scholar named Jeffrey Burton Russell, almost 30 years ago, wrote a book called Inventing the Flat Earth. It was a real expose of the whole thing. We've all been misled. I remember my son one year, I was curious, when he was in school, I looked at his textbook, and his textbook got it right, that, you know, about the history of the shape of the earth, but bless her heart, his teacher shared with him the culture mythology. Beyond all of that. And so by the time they got to him at the university, I had to unlearn him a lot of stuff before I could teach him anything. And I would have a class, you know, 20, 30 students, and not one of them knew the correct story of this. And it all goes back to the latter 19th century with what they call the conflict thesis, the idea that Christianity and science were at warfare with each other. And that was Exhibit A in the whole thing. It was a complete fabrication, a complete lie. Yet, you know, people let that lie persist, and when I try to straighten people out, they say that they think I'm making up the history. You know, because we've got this fake history going on there. But then a few other things also happened in the 19th century. There was a modern archaeology really got going in the 19th century, and they began to do excavations in Mesopotamia. And they began to uncover this cosmology that the Earth was this flat disk with a dome over top, and the stars and the sun and the moon were on that solid dome. It was a big vaulted arch sitting over the Earth. And they very quickly began to realize, well, this must be the ancient Near Eastern cosmology. And this got firmly ingrained pretty quickly. Now, as it turned out, later on, they found many other cosmologies. There was no single ancient Near Eastern cosmology. There were many other ones, but this suddenly became the only one out there. And the third thing that happened in the 19th century was the JEPD theory. This is the idea that the Pentateuch particularly was not authored by Moses, but yet was authored many centuries later using four different sources, the J, E, P, and D, and they were collated and edited together to get the Pentateuch. And if it was just kind of, you see this as a direct assault upon the authority and inspiration of Scripture. So if there are just these different sources there, then they're coming out of the ancient Near East, they would have reflected the cosmology. And this is coming from rank skeptics at first. And then there were some other, quote-unquote, Bible scholars who began to incorporate it. I just found out recently there was one book published a little more than a century ago, early part of the 20th century, that had this diagram in it of this domed, arch dome, solid dome with the Hades beneath, the whole thing of this supposed cosmology that the Bible teaches. What they did is they read a passage of Scripture and interpreted it in terms of this quote-unquote single A&E cosmology. Well, that was done by what was called a modernist then. These people were considered to be infidels, and conservative scholarship wanted nothing to do with it. But here we are 100 years later, and somewhat more conservative people have learned at the wrong schools, adopted the wrong things. And they're taking the rank liberals' ideas of 100 years ago and now teaching those. And so somewhere along the line, somebody in the flat Earth movement, found a book that said, "Well, this is a diagram of what the Bible teaches on cosmology." And I've had a couple people with internet conversations or emailing me, trying to convince me that I'm all wrong about this. And they they show me this proof. Here's a diagram. And I said, the Bible's cosmology. And I said, well, wait a minute. I have plenty of Bibles. I've looked at many plenty of Bibles, and I've never seen that diagram in any of the Bibles. Just where did you find that? This is man's interpretation of what the Bible says. It's not what the Bible says at all. And people then try to take biblical passages and interpret them that way. So just really, really is sad that you have people who are well-intended. They're reasonably conservative people. I think they're fairly orthodox in their theology.
Yep.
But they've bought into this huge whole pack of lies just about what the Bible teaches on this front. And it's packaged up so nicely, but it's really a bunch of liberalism from the past that's been repackaged for these people, and they don't have the discernment to see that.
Right. You know, and it does make us look bad when there is a large group of Christians that are on Facebook and on these, Twitter and these other social media and making videos, and they're pushing this idea that the Bible teaches a flat earth. That is not good. The gospel's offensive enough,
Yeah.
That's creating more problems.
Without looking for trouble like this, it's truly amazing. And I've written several articles that are on the Answers in Genesis website. I'm going to continue to write these articles. I've got a set of chapter in this book. I've got a chapter in my next book on this because, I put this current book to bed almost a year ago, like 9 months ago, and much has happened since that I've learned on the whole flat earth movement. So it's like a moving target almost. And I don't know how much longer this thing's going to continue to grow. It's came out of nowhere pretty quickly, and it's pretty frightening the number of people it's pulled in.
It really is. It really is. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I'm looking at this, okay, the flat earth model has the earth kind of flat like a pancake, if you can imagine that, or better yet, if you can imagine a clock, just a round clock, and that outer edge of the clock is actually the South Pole, and the very center of the clock, where the hands are coming out, that's the North Pole. Okay, in their model, that's how they put it, and that the South Pole is actually an ice ring around the perimeter of the Earth.
Well, they would say there is no South Pole. I mean, it's not clear how far out this perimeter goes, but they say you've got the idea right. It's a round flat Earth with a North Pole at the center. There is no South Pole. There's just a big ring of ice out there, and how far that ring goes, nobody knows, supposedly. So since there is no South Pole, no one's been there. Well, I've known people who have spent, 6 months at the South Pole station we have, research station. I guess they've lied about it all, I suppose.
that's because they're part of the Illuminati.
Part of the conspiracy, yep. And of course, you have to believe that in this model, it's domed over with this dome with the stars and sun and moon on it. So you can't have any space travel, so NASA has lied about everything it's done. We've never landed on the moon, never mind the fact that there are at least two Christians who walked on the moon, and there are numerous Christian astronauts who've orbited the Earth. They're all lying, too.
That's right.
And of course, as a PhD astronomer, I'm in a position to know better, and so I must be lying as well. But, no one's made that claim about me yet. I suspect that's coming. But no one's at least come to me and said, yeah, you're part of the conspiracy, too, and you're lying as well. The sheer volume of the amount of liars involved has to be incredible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you would think that there would even be pilots in airlines that would be in on it. I mean, the magnitude of the conspiracy would be just so vast. You've got space programs all around the world. And how would you ever keep that under wraps? All those satellites going up. I just don't see how it's possible.
You can see satellites with the naked eye, particularly in the summer. They reflect sunlight, and you see them after sunset and before sunrise. I've seen hundreds of them. I've seen the shuttle a number of times. I've seen the space station a number of times. And, their explanation is that there are a bunch of drones flying around. There has to be this huge amount of drones flying everywhere, because I can see the space shuttle here. It's a few hundred feet, maybe 1,000 feet up, but 20 miles away, somebody sees it too. So there must be another shot, another drone for them, and 100 miles away, people can see it. So it must be another drone. There's unbelievable tens of thousands of drones every night going up, flying around to make us think these are satellites.
Well, and I've even seen videos. Yeah, and I've seen videos where they've made claims that they were holograms.
Yeah.
what I feel like is irrefutable, and maybe I'm wrong here, but in the North Pole, on this flat map, if you will, if you can imagine this flat pancake, in the north, in the middle, you can see stars that can only be seen, you know, in the northern hemisphere. But on this flat Earth map, you can see those northern stars, if you will. Well, how is it that everybody on the south part of the Earth can see a different set of stars? There's some stars that you can't see from the north that you can see from the south. Well,
oh yeah, if you got this dome with stars in it, you can draw a line from any part of a dome to any part of the Earth. And so obviously we're all seeing the same stars. And as an astronomer, I study the stars. I've been watching the sky pretty seriously for 40 or 50 years. I have made at least 10 trips to the southern hemisphere. I've looked at the sky from southern hemisphere, four different continents. And I know the sky pretty well, and I can tell you very, very confidently that the North Star is not visible south of the equator. You just can't see it. And there are a bunch of stars south of the equator that you cannot see from where we live in the temperate latitudes. It isn't possible to see these things. I had somebody last year, I was exchanging emails, he was thoroughly convinced of the flat Earth. And he repeatedly corrected me, told me that I was wrong. You know, he just had this assertion from somebody, unnamed person more or less, that yes, you could see the North Star from the southern hemisphere. So therefore, I was wrong.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and I thought, you know, you're not talking to somebody who just fell off the turnip truck here. I've studied this stuff, and I've made trips to the southern hemisphere, and no, you cannot see these things. And these things I'm describing are impossible to understand in a flat Earth, but it's quite easy to explain in a spherical Earth. And yet these websites continue to claim otherwise, and on it goes.
Well, not only that, in the northern hemisphere, the stars rotate one way. And in the southern hemisphere, you see them, the appearance of them rotating the other way, which could only happen if you're on a globe.
Yep. Since there is no south pole in the flat Earth, there is no south celestial pole. So there's no point that you can see from the Earth where the whole sky will seem to spin around opposite from the north celestial pole. You know, that doesn't exist. It cannot exist. And again, I've been in the southern hemisphere. I've watched the sky on numerous nights. It does spin around a totally different point. And you're right. Since you're turning facing the other direction, it appears to go in the opposite way. Here in the northern hemisphere, if you face towards the north, the sky seems to go counterclockwise, but it goes clockwise in the southern hemisphere as you face the south.
There you go. I just don't see any way around that.
But you know what? What I find frustrating is I've dealt with several people like this. I tell them things like this. I think people would recognize me as an expert, so I can give expert testimony. But they would rather believe somebody on the internet. They don't know who this person is. But this person on the internet knows more than I do, or they're telling the truth, and for some reason I choose to lie. I can't figure it out. It beats all I ever seen. That tells you how deeply sunk into this indoctrination people have. It's crazy.
It is
crazy. There's no other word for it.
We love our rabbit trails. We love our tinfoil hattery, but it gets us in trouble. So.
Well, again, I think it goes back to pride. People, you know, falling into this thing and they've discovered this deep truth, and it gives them a lot of satisfaction that they have figured things out, but other people haven't. And I think that's an appeal of Christian Gnosticism I mentioned earlier.
That is interesting. I got to think about that. I think you're onto something there. I believe you're right.
I think it's the appeal to pride that gets them in, and then it's the pride that keeps them there. You remember you talked before about how disappointed you were when you found out about the gospel of stars being bogus. Well, you probably felt kind of stupid, didn't you?
Well, yeah.
So easily.
That's right.
And it's difficult. I mean, I understand that completely. If you have been fooled, it is difficult to admit that you've been fooled. It really is. It hurts to pride. I understand that. I've encountered that myself. And so if you've been duped so easily, it's very difficult then to admit that you've been duped, and you've got to change your thinking. And that's part of the problem. So pride gets you there, and pride keeps you entrapped at it, unfortunately.
I think that applies to people that are caught in various cults as well. But that's a rabbit trail we don't have time to go down. But
I'm not qualified to speak about that. So.
Well, something else you brought up in the book, and I know we're going, well, I guess we're not going too long. Something that everybody is going to want to hear from you, because I get this question all the time, and you probably get it a million times more than me, is the starlight time problem. We'll wait for that one. Yeah, we got stars out there that are supposedly billions of light years away. Well, that light is here. We can see it. And therefore, the logic, the reasoning is that that light's been traveling for billions of years. Therefore, the universe is billions of years old. And your chapter on it is awesome, because I love how it goes through the many different ways that Christians have tried to solve this. And then you get into more of how you believe is the correct answer. I'd love to hear about all of that, if you have time.
Okay. We call this the light travel time problem. I'll give you a real good nuts and bolts example. Generally, the most distant object you can see with the naked eye is the Andromeda Galaxy. If you know where to look exactly in the autumn sky, dark location, you can see it's a little smudge in the sky. In fact, we pointed it out there to Dale Tackett there in the movie Genesis History. You can see the little smudge in the sky, and that's about 2 million light years away. Now, I think that distance is reasonably correct, which means that if the speed of light has always been the same, it would have taken 2 million years to get here, which is appreciably longer than, say, 6,000 or 7,000 years that I think that the world has been around. So how can we see these things? But, you know, we've been concentrating on things at the end of time here, as it were, at least our perspective, thousands of years after the creation. But the situation is really far worse, because you see, Adam had a light travel time problem. Adam was made on day 6, and the stars were only made on day 4, just 2 days earlier. That's not a problem for the sun, the moon, and the planets, because they're only a matter of minutes or a couple hours away by light travel time. But the nearest star outside the solar system is more than 4 light years away. And so what did Adam see when darkness fell at the end of day 6 and beginning of day 7? Sky got dark. I think he saw stars, because if he didn't, then the stars could not fulfill their function. That's a very important key element there. I don't think he waited 4 years and all of a sudden, oh, there's one. In a few more years, there's another one. It took, you know, hundreds of years for the stars to gradually come on. They had to be there, visible, if not in the day 4, certainly by day 6, in order to see those. So if we can solve Adam's light travel time problem, I think we can solve our problem. And several things about the creation I think we misunderstand. One thing is, a lot of people think that everything on the creation week was ex nihilo, that is, out of nothing. Mm-hmm. Certain things were, particularly at the beginning, it had to be. But, you know, man wasn't made from nothing. God formed his body out of the dust of the earth, and out of the earth he formed him. If you read also in chapter 2, a little later on, you'll see that the flying things and the land animals also came out of the earth in a similar way. That was mind-changing for me when I finally noticed that a couple of years ago, pretty late, actually. And, you know, the dry land appeared out of the watery mass there on day 3. It just, I don't think it just poof, you know, was created out of nothing. I think it was brought up out of the water. Also on day 3, it talks about the plants. It says in verse 11, I believe, in the King James, it says, "And God said, let the earth bring forth." It describes the plants that were to be bring forth. And the next verse, he says, "And so the land brought forth these plants." You know, I don't know how many times I read that. Bring forth and brought forth, I just assumed it's the same Hebrew verb. Different tenses, perhaps, but actually it's two different Hebrew words, totally unrelated, but certainly overlapping. And bring forth is not bad. A translation, sprout or produce, those are used in some of the other modern translations. Those are good translations. But it also can be rendered thrust or shoot, grow. And if you look at the whole range of the meanings and really reflect upon it, I think if you it would be, would have been like a time-lapse movie. Just like the animals were brought out of the earth, I think the plants were brought up out of the earth. It was like normal growth, but abnormally fast, occurring in a matter of minutes or a couple hours. It had to happen less than a day. And, you know, the fastest producing plants from the time they're little saplings or seedlings up to producing fruit is probably 6 months, 6 weeks or more. In the case of trees, it could be decades. And there's a reason why God matured them quickly, because you had man and beast coming along 2 and 3 days later that we're going to rely upon that for food. You know, according to, I think, verse 30 of chapter 1, we were all vegetarian at the very beginning. So they all would have starved to death if they were not matured very quickly. So I believe what happened on day 4 is God not only made the heavenly bodies, but in order for them to fulfill their purposes, they had to be seen. And so I think God very rapidly brought that light forth, just like he brought the light, brought the plants out of the ground very quickly, and brought animals out of the ground on day six. And so I'm appealing here to a miraculous sort of thing, and some of the other explanations that we creationist plants have come up with have been more of a physical explanation. And, you know, I have to ask the question, what part of the miracle of creation don't you get? You know, nobody asked for a physical explanation for, or a natural explanation for the virgin birth, the resurrection, or the creation of matter and energy during creation week even. But suddenly when it comes to the light travel time problem, you suddenly want to restrict God to using the way things currently work. And I think that's fundamentally a mistake. We underestimate the nature of the miraculous of the creation week. You know, we call physics the study of the natural physical world. We have certain laws we can devise to try to describe mathematically how these things take place. Reminds me of Colossians 1, 16 and 17 and Hebrews 1, 1 through 3, where it talks about the Lord sustaining the current creation by the power of his word. God is sustaining, he's not creating, he's sustaining, because he stopped creating back on day 7. And that pattern and regularity we see makes science possible, makes physics possible, and we're just simply mathematically describing the manner in which the sustaining takes place. But it would be wrong to take that sustaining and extrapolate it back during the creation week. I think we're making the uniformitarian assumption that we accuse the evolutionist of using all the time. So that's my explanation. That's actually written up a little more in the book, but that's just a real quick 3 or 4 or 5 minute description of what I'm talking about.
I like it. So that is your book, The Created Cosmos. You've hinted that there is a companion book coming.
Yep, I don't call it a sequel. I call it a companion book. I've actually completed my draft of it. It's going, been through editing, and it's going through proofreading now. It ought to come out this summer, maybe August. Not sure when yet. Not sure the exact title yet either, but we're kind of theming it around it. You know, in this book, the first book we wrote, The Creator Cosmos, it's on just biblical astronomy, but I didn't talk about creation much. And, you know, we were creation scientists. There are scads of books out there on creation and creation science, but I didn't really address that in the book. So in this next book, it's going to be about the doctrine of creation as applied to astronomy. So I go through all sorts of things, astronomical topics, and just describe them and discuss them in terms of a recent creation model of astronomy.
Interesting. All right. Well, I'll pick that up when it comes
out.
Not
quite a sequel, more of a companion book, as I say, not as much a sequel. But it's going to be just as good as this book, I think.
It sounds fun. I'll pick it up, and then I'll be knocking on your door again to see if you want to come back and talk.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
That would be awesome. Now, another book that I do have in my library that you brought up during earlier, it sounds like you're going to be updating it, which is too bad because I just bought it a couple weeks ago, Universe by Design. Tell me about that.
Well, I wrote that in my first book a dozen years ago. It's a book about cosmology. You know, the big dominant cosmology for past half century has been the Big Bang. And I point out in there that it's difficulties with it biblically and scientifically. I need to update it for a number of reasons. For instance, there's some things that have come along in recent years that I didn't talk about yet because they weren't there yet being talked about. I also do a lot of history. I love history, and so I work that in there. I start off at the very beginning talking about the history of man's ideas about cosmology, and then build from there. So it's meant to be a pretty broad discussion of cosmology from a biblical worldview and perspective. It's a little tougher read, I guess, than this book I just wrote, because it's you know, it's dealing with some pretty weighty issues. It's I would say it's high school and above, have to be high school and above. This other book is probably a easier read for everybody, I believe. And I have one other book out. It's called The New Astronomy Book. It came out about 3 years ago. It's a kid's book primarily, but a lot of adults have read it. And it's about you know, fun stuff for kids and dealing with astronomy and creation. And it's really cool. The publisher saw to it that they organized it this way. It's done at three levels. It's color-coded. I know people who have used it for homeschooling, and they can use the book three times, because you can use level one, level two, and come back for level three. But again, even though it's a kid's resource, I've had a number of adult friends who were not scientists who read it and got a lot out of it. So it's a good book. Very colorful, a lot of illustrations.
And I'm seeing, by the way, friends, you can find everything that Danny has been involved in on answersingenesis.org. If you click on the store link, go in the store and then type in Danny Faulkner, you can find just, you know, all kinds of DVDs and, of course, the books we've talked about. I see here that you have the new book of astronomy, or I'm sorry, I said that wrong, the new astronomy book, and there's a bundle package that it comes with a DVD, Designs in Astronomy, which I would imagine is pretty good.
Well, that's a presentation I give. It talks about design aspects of, you know, if you expect, if there is a creator, then you expect certain design things about the world around us. I talk about three or four things that are dealing with astronomy and design. So it's a good supplement to that book.
Very cool. Well, Danny, it has been an honor to have you on the show. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay, we'll stop right there. That was pretty fun, wasn't it? So anyway, yeah, that was Dr. Danny Faulkner. Again, he's with Answers in Genesis. We were talking about his book, The Created Cosmos, a fascinating read. And so with that, yeah, we will stop here today, friends. Next week, we will most likely be hearing from, well, I'm waffling back and forth. Next week, we're either going to be hearing from David Harrison. We've had him on the podcast before. We talked about dinosaurs in the Bible. We're going to be talking about theistic evolution. But see, if I have David on next week, that'll be three episodes in a row that kind of touch on the topic of evolution. The other option, I'm going to be interviewing Kosti Hinn. Have you ever heard of him? Does that name sound familiar? Well, his uncle is Benny Hinn, the famous Benny Hinn. And Kosti, along with his father, traveled on many various crusades with Benny Hinn as he was growing up. He has a fascinating testimony. So we're going to be hearing from Kosti Hinn as well. And so I might just make that the next episode and come back to evolution later. We'll see how it pans out. But whatever the case, those are two episodes that are up and coming very soon here. And I've got other episodes in the works, so I'll keep those under wraps for the moment. With that, thanks for listening, guys. I love you. I'll see you next week.